Welcome to Research Reframed, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on research, insights, and data science. I'm your host, Jasmina Saleh, Director of Thought Leadership at National Research Group. We're a global insights consultancy at the intersection of content, culture, and technology. And in each episode, we dive deep into the trends, tools, and tensions that are shaping the future of the research industry.
At NRG, we have something called the Key Opinion Leaders Panel, KOL, or COL for short. It's a group of highly influential voices, people in government, policy thinkers, academics, communications professionals, and technologists who are shaping important decisions, conversations, and cultural undercurrents in real time. To walk us through what makes this panel unique and what he's been hearing from these experts on the biggest policy questions to date, from AI fears to whether the US is truly leading in the AI race, I'm joined by David Beiler, a VP on our Trends and Futures team who leads our work here on all things panels. Hi, David. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great. So before we jump into the really interesting stuff, let's just do a brief introduction on who you are and what you do at NRG.
Yeah, so I'm a VP on Trends and Futures. I work on a lot of different things, but basically I'm working a lot on AI and technology issues. I'm working a lot in the creator space, and I'm working both on, you know, kind of our bread and butter at NRG, which is figuring out what the general population of, you know, consumers in a given industry thinks. But one of my sort of projects is around these expert panels. One of them, as you mentioned, is COL, the KOL panel. These are basically people who are experts in a given field that NRG searches out, assembles, and kind of curates and puts into a panel. And we have personal relationships with these sort of like big groups of experts, and we poll them. We get their ideas. We do in-depth interviews. We do general surveys on what they think. So we've got this one for tech experts. We have one of high follower counts, social media creators. We have one of AI super users. So we've got that. And yeah, I guess a little bit more about me. In my previous life, I was actually a political data journalist. I spent about 9 years in that world, about half of that time at the Washington Post, just kind of covering national elections. But a few years ago, I moved into the world of survey research and then moved over to NRG, basically because it's fun to ask my own questions and get just one step closer to those opinions and that knowledge that everyone's just trying to get at in the world of both journalism and research.
Amazing. Thank you for that intro. And yeah, definitely the political data journalist, I'm sure, helps with all things panels. So, okay, in the simplest terms possible, I know you kind of touched a little bit on the Key Opinion Leaders panel, but I'd like you to dive a little bit deeper. So what is the Key Opinion Leaders panel at NRG and why does it matter?
Yeah, so the Key Opinion Leaders panel is our panel of over 100 experts on tech policy. They come from Fortune 500 companies, from, you know, former government officials, academia, basically anywhere where you have kind of special insight or where you have extra influence into tech policy, you're going to find key opinion leaders. And those are the people we went after. It's a sample that's, you know, we tried to balance it on a couple core variables. I think the most important one is politics. We have people who are of a liberal persuasion, of a conservative persuasion, and we just kind of have a convening of experts that have a diverse set of perspectives. Why is this important? You know, I think that when most people get an expert view on what's happening in the world of tech policy, they get it in a really, really limited format. A lot of the times when you see expert views, it's the format is you're reading an article, it's reported in a traditional journalism outlet, and the author has interviewed somewhere between one and five experts whose quotes show up in the piece. And, you know, it flows in a narrative way, but it's just a view of a handful of people. And you're trusting whoever the author or journalist of that piece is to give you the expert consensus. And there's some opaqueness there. There's kind of a limited set of opinions you see there. And so what we want to try to do is kind of evolve that a little bit here. So like I said, we have 100 plus people and we poll them. So we're getting a broad range of experts. We're asking them all the same questions and we're reporting our findings. And so it's kind of like having a big convening of experts of different beliefs and persuasions all at once, answering the same questions. It's like all of the advantages of a traditional survey applied to a group of highly curated experts. So I think this gives kind of a better than anywhere else view into what's actually happening in the world of tech policy, because tech policy is, it's technical, it's opaque, it's difficult, it's fast changing. You kind of need expert views, and being able to get 100 good ones aggregated at the drop of the hat is, I think, kind of a great way to make sure you understand what's actually going on in this world.
No, that's great for sure. I mean, 100 specialist diverse perspectives are really going to tell you what's actually going on. Okay, now that we know what it is and why it's unique, can we talk about what you found? So I believe you have three key trends in particular that we're touching on today, the first being the AI policy problem. So can you tell me a little bit more about what you're hearing from experts when it comes to AI regulation, or let's be honest, the lack thereof?
Right. So what we're hearing right now is that the Trump administration is really in the driver's seat for a lot of what's going on in the world of regulation, right? So basically, right now, the Trump administration's position is that there's not a lot of regulation of AI coming out of the federal government. They've even gone so far as attempting to squash state-level regulations of AI. Their ideology on this, actually, as revealed in a lot of sort of interviews we've had with the KOLs, their ideology on this is kind of very build, baby, build, like accelerate, build as much AI as possible, let the companies, hyperscaler AI companies, really just do what they want to do to build bigger, better, faster models, try to help them with data centers. And that's kind of the policy. And it's an interesting space because obviously the president is sort of the focal point of that feeling. And you have on the left some countermeasures. You have some sort of, you know, kind of scattered attempts at saying, oh, well, we should regulate the environmental impact of AI, or we should increase transparency. And you have maybe an individual governor or an individual senator or someone here or there on the left doing something different. But it's a landscape that's dominated by a really big deregulatory impulse. And that's where it is right now. You know, we can talk about ways that might change, might not change, et cetera. But from talking to the Coles, that federal effort just to like develop as fast as possible and let private U.S. companies develop as fast as possible is really the sort of guiding and governing thought in AI right now.
I think something that was really interesting from that article that you mentioned was the idea of like loss of control, that regulation is going to speed up and step in if people feel like machines are taking over any domain of their lives. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
So recently we asked our panelists a really simple question. It was, what warning signs or conditions might cause the government to step in more aggressively to regulate or intervene in AI and tech markets? You know, and what we kind of expected on this question was a pretty simple answer, something like, oh, when Democrats, you know, eventually retake the presidency, there will be regulation or something like that. What we got was something very different. What we got was almost all of the Coles speaking about a loss of control that someone might have in their life. And that if there's a large sector of the public that feels like they've lost control, that would be what generates a bottom-up political movement that would cause regulation. So some of the examples, obviously there's jobs, you know, people, some of the Coles said that if there's significant disruption in the job market, that could cause regulation to happen. Another one was that, you know, when AI makes financial decisions that affect the stock market swiftly and negatively, that could cause people to feel like they've lost control over some core aspect of their lives. And that could be something that causes AI regulation to happen. But it really, the responses we got went far beyond that, right? So unauthorized drone strike, errors with self-driving cars, deep fakes that cause people to feel that they've lost privacy, AI-driven fraud, anytime a model sort of goes rogue. And the common thread between all these responses we've got is that the Coles don't think that people will respond well to AI causing a loss of control in some important aspect of their lives. And it was interesting to hear this from them, because that brought an extra focus to what we're seeing in general population surveys of Americans as well, which is that if you ask Americans what uses of AI they're comfortable with, they're really comfortable with things that don't involve decisions around them. Like, people really love the idea that AI can make weather forecasting more accurate. They really, really do not like the idea of, you know, AI making hiring decisions or AI doing jury selection or something like that. So it's the idea that the factor that would spur regulation of the AI industry isn't necessarily jobs or national security or one of these political categories. It's a bigger emotional category, which is that a feeling of loss of control when that happens in an area like jobs or national security or what have you, that's what might cause regulation. And so that felt like a deep insight to me. And I, you know, wrote about it for the site. And yeah, I think that's kind of an important meta thing that Colson pointed out.
Yeah, for sure. And I believe you also recently did a piece on AI and stress and said that people aren't stressed about using AI, but they are stressed thinking about it, which feels like a very similar sentiment. So just to summarize, essentially, the takeaway here is, as you put it in your article, when humans feel like machines have taken power from them in any domain of their lives, that's when AI regulation policy could change extremely quickly.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, let's move on to trend number two. Straightforward question. Is the US winning the AI race against China? If yes, why and how?
Yeah, great question. This is one that we ask in our most recent survey. It was during Q4, and this was another one where the answers surprised us. So we had 79% of the panelists said that the US was ahead of China in the AI race. And the way that we structured this sort of like 2-3 question vignette was simple, but it really worked for the type of experts that the Coles are. So we asked them just straightforwardly, you know, is the US or China or some other countries ahead? You know, 80% said the US in the global AI race. And then we asked them why. And the answer was chips, 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 chips. Hardware stack, hardware stack, hardware stack. So essentially, there's a couple different ways that you could have an advantage in the AI race and a couple different ways you can conceive of the AI race. But what the Coles were saying is that it's not that the US has, you know, better LLMs. It's not that the US has some innovative policy. It's not just that the US, you know, had sort of a lead on building some of these things over other countries. It's that NVIDIA primarily and other chip makers are these US-based sort of companies that are allowing a better infrastructure to be built in the United States, and then that keeps the US ahead of China. One thing that was actually pretty interesting is that is the Coles also volunteered their opinions on whether that lead will last. That was a lot more split. There were some Coles who just said that, you know, the AI race is a situation where the first mover advantage is critical and the US has this advantage and we're going to just kind of run with it. And, you know, the US will stay ahead because it's ahead. That was one argument, right? Another was that, you know, the chip advantage is really, really important. And so I think the US will stay ahead because of that. Some thought that China will overtake the US. It's just a bigger market, it's better equipped for some of the labor. Some people, you know, had other reasons, but you had kind of differing opinions on the strength of the US's lead, and you had a lot of unanimity about who was actually ahead.
Okay. First question that comes to mind is, are all these experts on this panel American? Because if you're saying 80% said that America is obviously ahead in the race, that's obviously something I need to ask and consider, because if so, then we need to dig a little bit deeper into how do we interpret this confidence, and is it a genuine reflection of a structural advantage?
I do think it's a genuine reflection of a structural advantage. And the factor I would point to here is that we have a panel that has a diverse partisanship. So yes, the experts are American, but a lot of them would have some kind of viewpoint that is critical of the Trump administration and critical of some of our experts are, you know, really big believers in the AI companies. Some of our experts have reservations about what AI companies do and what their policies are and have, you know, things like there's just a wide set of opinions on politics itself, on the AI companies within our expert panels. And so my thought was that, you know, if there's a question like this and a Coal thinks that, you know, the US policy is bad, they have the option of punching the China button and explaining why China is actually ahead, or punching. We had an other response in that question too. They could have said other, it's a tie, or other, nobody's ahead. I think maybe one or two Coles picked a third country. But there's a lot of reasons that someone in this panel might have to not say the US, even though they are Americans. And I think one for this panel in particular, I think making it heavy on sort of US experts makes sense because so much of what's happening in AI is happening in the US and in China. I think in other industries, obviously, it's different and different industries are distributed differently across the globe. But for this one, I don't think that the fact that it's a basically American panel is going to bias our results because so many of our experts would have some other reason to feel motivated to give some answer other than the US.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's that question of longevity that you said, the longevity of that lead. So from my understanding, from what you're saying, is that a lot of that confidence in the US, in the US lead in particular, comes from that chip advantage, that hardware stack. But what we're now seeing is that China is adapting. We're seeing US policy shift around exports. So for context, President Trump announced that the United States would lift restrictions on selling highly advanced semiconductors to China, which means by lifting export controls on chips, that actually jeopardizes America's AI advantage. So David, when you put those pieces together, where do you think expert consensus might be a little too comfortable on this topic?
Well, in defense of the calls, we did this poll prior to, I think it was in December, one of the announcements on Trump changing the policy on chip exports. We did this poll in, you know, kind of the October-November range. And I think some of the changes in chip policy came after this happened. And my intention is to re-poll the panel next time we're in the field and say, you know, what do you think? And my guess, if I had to hazard a guess, is that some of our panelists will change their answer. I think some of them might say it's a tie or might say that, you know, the U.S. is no longer ahead or punt one of those other options instead of the U.S. It's interesting, though, what you say about some of these other factors, because In the 20-ish percent of Coles who said that China was ahead, they made some of the arguments that you're talking about, that China is fully capable of catching up when it comes to chips, and probably it will catch up when it comes to chip based on their assessment of the Chinese economy, the Chinese, you know, political system, and so on and so forth. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, polls are a snapshot in time, even polls of experts. So I'd be curious to see how the Coles reacted. Having done a good bit of surveying with them, my guess is that a lot of them have adjusted their thoughts based on the events that they didn't foresee. And a number of them did foresee events and, you know, might spike the football a little bit in some of those open-endeds.
That's completely fair. There was something else that really caught my eye in your article about this as well, where you said it's less clear who will win the AI race in the long run, right? But more importantly, what does it even mean to win this race? Based on the conversations you've been having with experts, what's your take on this and what do you think that actually looks like?
Yeah, so we tried something that worked out pretty well with one of our survey questions, which was instead of talking about the AI race, one thing that we talked about was the AI Olympics. So if you think about AI, the race is so poorly defined, right? Like, what does it mean to win the AI race? Does it mean that you have a human level intelligence that's, you know, as cheap as electricity to all users in a company that's based in the US? Is that what it means? Does it mean that you have the best breakthroughs in science and technology where AI has cured diseases and has, you know, eliminated a lot of suffering? Does it mean that your AI has improved your economy? Your AI industry has improved your economy so much that, you know, you're more productive and that, you know, your economy is better equipped to handle recessions? Does it mean that there's jobs automated? Does it mean that, what does it mean to win the AI race? It's kind of an open question that is asked all the time without really being defined. So one thing that we did is we broke it down into something like 8 different areas and asked our experts who's ahead in different areas. So without going through all the nuts and bolts and nitty gritty of it, basically, they think that different companies are winning different parts of the AI race. So everyone agrees that NVIDIA is winning sort of an infrastructure and chips race. A lot of Coles think that Amazon is well positioned to automate jobs. A lot of people think that OpenAI is in a very good position when it comes to like consumer LLM usage and just getting this into sort of the bloodstream of life across the globe. For science, a lot of our experts thought that Google was doing a good job. And it was interesting because we also asked them which one of these events, sort of in the AI Olympics rather than the AI race framing, which one of these events was most important. And if memory serves, they actually said that science was sort of the critically important area. I think that was one of the most important, if not the most important one, was using AI to, you know, have breakthroughs with life sciences in particular, with medicine, with things where the impact will be huge for people, but it won't necessarily land in the consumer's lap. So what does it mean to win the AI race? I guess my answer to that is kind of great question, lots of things. And yeah, different groups are doing well in different aspects of it.
That actually makes me feel really positive that you're saying the science element. So it's like how AI can have a huge impact on lives. Like, I think that's great. And that's not necessarily kind of a narrative that we hear a lot of. So love that. Okay, we're moving on to trend number three. So a big focus of yours with the panel was business policy, especially around DEI and ESG. Can you A, refresh our memory on what happened in terms of corporate America and policy in that space? And then B, what did experts think of the situation? What was their recommendation to businesses in terms of who's responsible for what and especially when?
Yeah, so it might feel like a lifetime ago, but when Trump was getting sworn in for his second term, you know, the second time around, he had the four-year gap where Biden was president in the middle of his two terms. And the second one, there was what you might call a vibe shift, where a lot of corporations chucked their DEI policy. A lot of corporations adopted a sort of a focus on diversity, equity, inclusion, kind of more progressive or liberal social causes. They adopted that sort of in 2020 and 2021. You can think of that as the COVID era. You can think of that as the George Floyd protest era. During that time, a lot of big companies sort of responded and moved left. And a lot of them took Trump's election as a signal to jettison all of that immediately. And what we did is, about 6 months into Trump's second term, we pulled the Kohls and we gave them a series of questions to try to get a little bit more detail here, right? Is it the case that no company can take any political position? Is it the case that companies are safe taking conservative positions? Is it the case that there are some liberal positions you can take? Or, you know, we're just trying to get a little bit of an expert sense of what might be safe for companies to do or not do, depending on what they believe. So what we found was that the pendulum had not swung all the way back to 2020 by mid-2025. It had not come all the way back to sort of protest era, a sense of corporate policy, but it had swung back some. And our basic headline finding was that if a company has some kind of business reason to take a position that is at odds with the administration or that is liberal or progressive or what have you, that's actually pretty solid ground for them to stand on. That we're not in an era where companies are, you know, necessarily going to be taking all kinds of progressive positions on all kinds of things spontaneously. But if you can say that this progressive policy you're taking, say, on immigration impacts your workforce, that's something where you're on sort of safer ground. So to give you a couple numbers to kind of flesh this out a little bit, we had the Kohls pick between two statements, a set of two statements, and sort of a series of sets of two statements. So one of them was enforcing immigration policies is bad for business versus enforcing immigration laws strengthens the business environment. So our Kohls thought 60-40, enforcing immigration laws strengthens business. But when we asked them a different set of questions, we asked them to choose between these two statements. Companies should speak out when immigration policies threaten their workforce or business operations, and companies should adapt quietly to changing immigration policies and avoid publicly challenging government decisions. 72% of them picked that first option. So I know that's a lot of words, so just to recap real quick, the Kohls basically were split 50-50 saying, you know what, immigration or 60-40 saying immigration enforcement is good for business. But by a 70-30 margin, they said, you know, if an immigration policy is impacting your workforce, you should really speak out about that. We had similar numbers come out when we asked them about sort of crisis situations, right? So 66% agreed that when government actions threaten civil rights or public trust, companies have a duty to use their influence to protect democratic norms and community well-being. The word influence is doing a lot of work there. Using your influence can look different ways for different companies at different times. But basically, they said, okay, if there's a true crisis situation, you're probably on solid or safe ground to take some action. But, and this is another complication here, when we asked them to choose between the options of companies should issue statements aligned with their stated values when major protests occur, even if there's backlash, or companies should prioritize internal action over public statements, the calls recommended prioritizing internal action over public statements. So it's a situation that's nuanced. It's a situation where that's evolving too, where, you know, 2020, we have protest era, a real push for progressive policies within corporations. 2024, the election happens. A lot of companies sort of get spooked, abandon sort of progressive corporate policies. And what our calls are saying is that Trump's popularity is deteriorating somewhat, and you don't have all the room that you did in 2020 to move left. But if you've got a good reason to promote some kind of liberal policy that is important for your business, you've probably got that room, that your sort of window to take political stances as a corporation has changed. This might have changed even more in the time since we pulled this, but that was a finding that I kind of, a level of nuance, the finding I hadn't seen anywhere else, that also passed the smell test of, you know, what makes sense in this political environment.
Yeah, for sure. I found that really interesting, the idea of like the duty to step in if the prerequisites are it threatens your business and your workforce and kind of democracy as a whole.
Right. You got to have the right reason, right? Yeah.
You got to have the right reason. As always, these conversations we have on this podcast aren't just about what's happening now, but where we are going next and how this impacts the future. So, David, looking ahead and based on the conversations you've been having with the experts on the KOL panel, what's one signal leaders should be paying closer attention to right now and why?
I might give you more than one. One is the political, and there's kind of two, I guess, sub-signals within that. One is the midterm elections. So the historical pattern in U.S. elections is that during the midterm election, and there will be one in November of this year, the party that does not control the White House tends to do very well. They tend to gain seats in the House, they tend to gain seats in the Senate, they tend to do well in the states. So right now, there are exceptions to that rule, but the early expectation is that there will be some sort of change where Republican power on AI regulation and on all areas of policy is going to erode somewhat if Democrats make the gains that history suggests that they will. So that's one simple signal. One a little bit more complicated political signal is the Democrats kind of figuring out what they're about, right? Like, suppose that there's a Democratic House majority a year from now. What do they try to do on AI? We don't really completely know yet, right? Another thing that's going to happen is the Democrats are going to nominate a candidate for president. That person will either get elected or not get elected. What do they think about AI? We don't really know that a lot. So there's natural parts of the calendar that are going to unfold that really matter politically. There's also the economic factors. There's kind of the ever-present, forever happening bubble conversation where some experts think that there's overinvestment in AI and, you know, there's going to be a pullback that's going to cause an economy-wide crash. Others say that, you know, AI is delivering real returns and that there's not going to be a crash. That's just going to be grow. So one thing to look at is obviously the macroeconomic effects on their own terms, but also what's the political fallout of the macroeconomic effects, right? Like, if there is an AI-driven recession, does that change the White House's policy on AI regulation at all? We don't know. If there is no AI recession and it's just growth, baby growth, then does that, you know, strengthen the anti-regulation sort of political coalition? Maybe so. So there are some events on the calendar politically that you can see exactly when they're going to happen and know something of the consequences that they're going to have. And then you also have to sort of plan for the surprises and figure out how to expect the unexpected. Nobody knows how the economy is going to evolve. I had a boss once who said that if he knew what the economy was going to do in 6 months, he would be living on a boat somewhere hot. Like, I think nobody knows that, right? So those are some of the things to be on the lookout for. And then I guess the last third bucket would just be adoption of AI advancements and AI advancements themselves, you know, is this a year when adoption of AI agents jumps dramatically? Is this a year where, you know, the AI integrations that we're starting to see in a lot of different devices really take off in a new way that we haven't seen before? That's kind of a third thing. So I guess, as I've talked about it, I've come up with three things: the known political calendar, the economic ? And then the advances in the technology itself that seem to be coming at a very rapid pace.
Phenomenal. And with that, we are officially done with this episode. Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate you taking the time, and everything's been so interesting. I can't wait to have you back on the show with more things from the different panels, whether it's tech experts, KOL, or the creator panel. So everyone, keep your ears perked.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. That's it for this episode of Research Reframed. If you enjoyed today's discussion, please subscribe and share. And if you'd like to dive deeper into the topics we covered, you can check out David's KOL Compass newsletter on Substack or find out more about our research on our website, nrgmr.com. Links are in the show notes. Research Reframed is produced by National Research Group, a global insights consultancy at the intersection of content, culture, and technology. Thanks for listening, and keep your ears perked for upcoming episodes where we'll dig into everything from AI methodologies to brand tracking myths to the future of qual. We'll see you next time.